This is Matt Bieberfeld, Assistant General Manager of WRVR, and next to me at the table is Pete Feldman, producer of Listen. And our special guest today is the Reverend William Sloan Coffin, Jr., who's chaplain at Yale University, one of the most outspoken critics of the United States policy in Vietnam. We thank you for coming, Dr. Coffin.
Good morning, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to sort of start with an overview in this conversation. What do you think has been the overall effect of your actions and your statements about an individual's conscience?
Well, I think it's very hard to judge what the effect is. Let's start abroad, if only because people often forget that part of the effectiveness of the protest movement has to be measured in what people think abroad. As you probably are aware, 80% of Europeans polled think withdrawal, our extreme position on our spectrum, is the only decent, moderate thing Americans could do in Vietnam at this moment. Therefore, the whole protest movement is probably the only thing in this country which keeps alive the flicker of hope that the American dream is not turned totally into a nightmare. So certainly from that point of view, the protest movement, and especially those perhaps who are going to jail, are being very effective. I think also one has to think in terms of the future. Thoreau was gloriously ineffective in his time. But he, by his example, put something into the mainstream of American history which is nourishing us over 100 years later. It seems to me our willingness to protest and, if necessary, to go to jail is a small measure of devotion which we owe a generation as yet unborn. I want my grandchildren to know that there were those who chose to protest what seems to me is a deeply wicked thing and were willing to go to jail if necessary to do so. So I think in terms of effectiveness, while it's hard to judge the present at home, it's easy to judge it abroad now, and I think for the future of America.
In practical political terms, do you think that you're having any effect on voters in the United States?
Well, the indictment has served us well. We're now looking much more respectable. People who thought we were wild and woolly now think, well, they really meant what they said when they said they'd take the legal route. The trial is going to be a lawyer's trial. It's not going to be a circus. And I think combined, of course, with the Tet Offensive, which has brought about a vast reevaluation of the war in America, has served to make us look, as I say, a little bit more respectable and perhaps a little more on target than most people thought we were.
Do you think the Tet Offensive in Vietnam is causing a real dialogue among the political leaders in Washington?
It certainly is among the military leaders, because a great many of them are feeling that Westmoreland is a latter-day George Custer by what he's done up at Khazan. And the way we've been training our troops to fight the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong is highly reminiscent of the way Braddock trained his troops for the French and Indian Wars. So certainly among the military, there's a great deal of reassessment. And I guess we'll see tonight how much change of heart the president may have.
What would you like to see the United States do in Vietnam?
I would like to see very clear demonstration that we have changed our intent, that our intent is to get out. Now, the implementation of that intent is obviously a very difficult thing to work out. It will take lots of time. It'll take lots of expertise. So I guess in summary, I would like to see a very carefully planned, negotiated extrication of the United States from Vietnam.
You talked about your indictment, and you have chosen to fight the indictment, which was on charges of conspiracy. Do you think that if you have a lawyer's trial, which is the way you just described it, that you will be able to bring home any point about United States involvement in Vietnam? I think I may really be asking, what is your defense going to be?
Well, Matt, as the lawyers would say, surely, Reverend Coffin, you're not going to discuss the merits of the case anyplace, are you? But let me say that you have taken wings to the heart of a dilemma, namely that the best legal stand may not be the best public stand. That the things we would like to argue, the constitutionality of the war, the constitutionality of certain aspects of the draft, may be very difficult things to get into a trial where people are charged with conspiracy. So we may have to end up, and I hate the idea of this, showing that the conspirators really didn't conspire, which is a fact. From any commonsensical point of view, the notion of conspiracy is ridiculous. The first time the five of us met, I had to introduce everybody. But This is the difficulty, that what constitutes the best legal defense may not be the best public stand. But we finally decided that we still have to fight it, because if we allow a conspiracy charge to stand, then it'll be just much too easy for the government to charge almost anybody with conspiracy.
What is the next step in the trial? You're out on bail, as it were, right?
That's
now,
right.
Aren't you?
Motions will be argued on April 17th. That is, we submitted a series of motions, including a motion that the indictment be thrown out, and the government submits counter motions. The judge hears them argued. If the motions don't carry, then the trial date is set, and then we get underway, hopefully, by end May.
I'm interested in asking you, Reverend Coffin, you come out of an upper middle or even an upper class background. Your father was a vice president of W&J Sloan Company. Your wife is the daughter of Arthur Rubinstein, the world famous pianist. And you're chaplain at Yale University, which is certainly an upper middle class university at the very least.
Well, yeah, let's change it.
Judging by the amount of money it takes to become enrolled at Yale, let's put it that way.
But you see, a scholarship.
I see. In any case, you do represent, though, a dissenting voice out of the establishment. What effect is this having upon people who hear you preach, both at Yale and around the country?
Well, I suppose it has, if you approach it from that point of view, it has two results. Some will say you're a traitor to your class, you know, and in the tradition of FDR and so forth. But I think many others feel that this is what's right and proper, that those who've taken the most out of this world have a responsibility to put something back in, that those of us who are lucky enough to be born reasonably well off with all the privileges of education and good families and all the rest of it have an especial obligation to be responsible in this world. And quite frankly, that's what distresses me very deeply, that, for instance, the business community, by and large, if we can make a generalization, has proved to be a community of practicing cowards to such a degree that common integrity has been made to look like courage in this country. It seems to me that the better off one is in this society, the higher one climbs on the so-called ladder of success, the greater one's responsibility to speak out. But unfortunately, again and again, the higher you go in American society, the blander you become. So we now have a society of the bland leading the bland, as somebody once said.
Now, there's another great American tradition of separation of church and state. And you are instrumental in the formation, I believe, of an organization called Clergy and Laymen Concerned About Vietnam.
Right.
What kind of questions do people ask you when they want to know why is it important for a religious leader to be speaking out about a situation like Vietnam? Aren't you, in a sense, defying this tradition of separation of church and state?
That's what a lot of people think, but I think it's a very fundamental misunderstanding. Separation of church and state has nothing to do, says nothing about a Christian or a Jew being separated from his politics. I think probably the first time that a minister was told he shouldn't meddle in politics was when Pharaoh saw Moses, who probably went on to say, also Moses, seeing you're one of these preacher types, you don't understand economics, namely the tremendous economic recession that will take place here in Egypt if suddenly you remove all these Israelite slaves in the Egyptian economy. I think one makes a distinction between clergymen and politicians, not in terms of their concerns, but at what point they tie into these concerns. For instance, the Old Testament prophets say, let justice roll down like mighty waters, but they don't pretend to be experts in irrigation. Now, it's up to the politicians to figure out the irrigation system, but it's up to the preachers and all religious folk to make sure that justice is the central concern of the church, that war and peace is a central concern of the religious community. And this is where I think we fail terribly in the religious community in this country. We have not let war be the central concern of the church, or racism, or poverty. We've been terribly concerned with free love, but pretty indifferent to free hate. And I think now is that many of us are beginning to feel that we must right this order of priorities to get war and peace, justice and race right at the top of the church agenda.
Now, you've talked about the role of the church, and I gather you think it's failed in K-12 carrying out at least this role of leadership. But you have come off being a hero for a lot of young people. You were on the cover of the New York Times magazine on March 3rd. How do you react to becoming a hero for young people?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm a hero, you know, because I keep telling myself those wonderful words of Luther, God can carve the rotten wood and ride the lame horse. I think that young people are yearning for spokesmanship. I think people are longing to hear somebody get up and say it the way it is, you know. And I don't think that's restricted to young people either. I think the reason why McCarthy is having such a tremendous response and Senator Kennedy is because they're saying some of the things that need desperately to be said in this country. So I think in this sense, perhaps, I've become a modest kind of a spokesman, but not a hero. Let me say one thing, and I don't want to give the idea that I think the church has failed totally. I think you could say that there's a deep chasm running through the church today. On one side sit a great many young priests, nuns, ministers, and a lot of young laymen who really want the church to turn itself inside out like a sock, you know, just to pour itself out for the world theologically. They're saying, good God, if Christ, the head of the church, could give up his life for humanity, the body of Christ must be valiant to do no less. On the other side of that chasm sit very conservative laymen in the Protestant church who vote the money and put on the brakes, and in the Roman Catholic church, the bishops. There's a big difference between the hierarchy and the lowerarchy in the Roman Catholic church. Now, I think this is a fact of life, that this chasm goes right through the church, and it will continue to split the church for some time. This is healthy. We mustn't be afraid of splitting the church. It's dangerous theology to improve on Jesus, and he split the religious community right down to its very core. So I kind of rejoice in the conflict in the church today. I think it's the healthiest thing there is. I hope we can keep our differences in the context of a lover's quarrel. But I think it's necessary that we recognize these deep differences and we really try and work them out.
When a young person comes to you who is draft eligible and says that he is morally opposed to the war in Vietnam, what kind of advice do you give him?
First of all, I tell him I admire his willingness to be vulnerable to a moral issue. And then I give him a lot of sympathy because I think he's got a real dilemma. I feel myself as a pastor, I would have no right either to push a man into civil disobedience, tell him, you know, to refuse induction, go to jail, nor on the other hand to try to push him out of what might constitute for him a moment of truth. Because there's nothing worse than pushing a man away from a moment of truth. Then along comes the second, third, and fourth moment of truth, and of course they can be that much more easily avoided. So I guess what I usually try to do is ask them very difficult questions about how to find out how deeply committed they are, to find out what their vocational future might be. It's one thing for a minister to go to jail. It's something else for a man who wants to be a member of Airedale, Whippet and Pug down on Wall Street. You know, if he's going to be a criminal lawyer, let's say, and has a wonderful vocational commitment because we need criminal lawyers, it would be too bad to jeopardize that possibility. Then there are questions about his family. What about his father and mother in that small western Ohio town? What will happen to them? What about that mixed-up 17-year-old kid brother who will drop out of high school and get himself in jail, and psychologically he's not ready? These are the kinds of questions I think that one has to try and work out. But it is eminently a personal decision. Every man has to decide for himself.
What about the person who comes to you who is draft eligible but is not morally committed against the war in Vietnam? He just simply wants to avoid going into the army. What do you tell him?
Well, I don't see many of those.
So you don't really have anything?
I'm not sure, really.
That's good.
Yeah.
I think there is a feeling in the United States today of being a very small part of a very big machine.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a feeling that as an individual, it's really impossible to change the world.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that Every other morning you wake up feeling like a sensitive grain of wheat looking at a millstone. And there's not much you can do except say, "Hi, millstone, whom are you grinding up today?" You know, something like that. But on the other hand, particularly since the students put McCarthy on the New Hampshire map, there certainly in the student world has been a new sense of purpose and possibility. And, of course, the fellows who are turning in their draft cards are taking advantage of the real leverage which they have. They say, you know, well, there's not much we can do. We haven't got any National Association of Manufacturers, no American Medical Association, American Bar Association to stand up for us and speak for us. But one thing we have, our draft cards. One thing we know, the United States Army wants us. Therefore, our refusal to serve is really using the maximum leverage which we have. And for this, I admire their realism as well as their courage. And I think those who have turned in their draft cards and those who are refusing induction are beginning to feel that they're not only perhaps serving dictates of conscience, but may actually be serving an important cause in a rather important way.
There have been other methods of trying to show an effect, and I'm talking about the demonstrations which have taken place. Mm-hmm. There was a spring mobilization in New York. There was the March on Washington. Do you think that the orderly, peaceful demonstrations such as was held in the spring in New York City, or the so-called attempt to close the Pentagon, which may or may not have been orderly, depending on whose story you listen to, do you think that they can have any real effect?
Yes, I think there are several things that are important about them. One, as you just finished saying, a lot of people feel kind of lonely. It's a lonely, long, stony road, this road to peace, and they feel they're walking it pretty much alone. Now when they see hundreds and thousands walking it with them, this is very good for the morale. So from this point of view, I think demonstrations have been very important to build up morale, to give a sense of community. Secondly, when, as here in New York, hundreds of thousands turned out, it makes dissent a little bit more respectable, a little bit more possible for other people who have been a little bit more timid. And I think it does have a certain effect on the government. Again, abroad, it has a tremendous effect. I mean, the citizens' army going up against the citadel of American power down there at the Pentagon, why, that just went over in a tremendous way in France. You know, why, look at that. It's just like the Bastille, only they're not even armed, these American citizens, you know. And the Germans looked at that and said, "Um Gottes Willen, you know, we haven't seen Americans rise up like this and go against the citadel of power. This is beautiful." And once again, in this sense, it was very effective. And, of course, the Germans and the French get through the embassies over there and say, you know, you're beginning to look a little bit silly. Don't you think you ought to stop this war? So in that sense, also, it's effective. Now, what constitutes a pressure for peace and what constitutes an incitement to a right-wing reaction is, of course, the hardest question to answer. And there again, in terms of time, it's hard to answer. I think the Pentagon demonstration at the time was more an incitement for a right-wing reaction. But then as people began to see that most of the violence came from the government side, then as the war became more and more unpopular, then as Norman Mailer wrote the whole thing up in one of the most brilliant pieces of journalism in the 20th century, then it began to look a little better and better. And I think in historical perspective, the Pentagon will be something really quite wonderful and heroic. And I'm going to be a little bit sorry that I wasn't there. I
think. One other thing about that. Do you think that there's a danger that people will go out on a demonstration and come away talking about how great the demonstration was, and that in some way demonstrations tend to sap off the anger and the frustrations that a person feels so that he becomes, after a demonstration, less effective a voice than he was before the demonstration?
Well, every human being is in danger of being committed to the cross in principle while avoiding it in practice. And we'll look for endless ways of avoiding sacrifice. So there is that danger. On the other hand, I think in my experience, the amount of morale and hope that a demonstration arouses in the breasts of the faithful more than offsets this drainage of commitment that you're afraid of. So I think on balance, demonstrations tend to be much more positive for those taking part in them than negative.
Talking about demonstrations, what do you think the effect of such demonstrations is on the average voter, let's say in the Middle West, who is basically more or less conservative?
Well, again, this is a real problem, isn't it? On the one hand, they make a lot of noise, and it sounds like there's going to be a real right-wing reaction. On the other hand, we have to face the fact that what we've learned in the civil rights movement is that the average voter, the average white voter, let's say, does not react to injustice. He only reacts to disorder. Most of us want peace at any price, which means peace for us as long as somebody else is paying the price. We're very much like Al Capone, you know, who said when he had all Chicago wrapped up, we don't want no trouble. And it's only when other people show they're not willing to pay the price. It's only when there is trouble. It's only when Watts explodes that Los Angeles reacts. So human nature being very prevalent, I've come to the conclusion that without some kind of disorder, peaceful, nonviolent disorder, and perhaps, ghastly as this may be, perhaps without violent disorder, most of us are so deeply complacent that we're not going to react. So I'm much less impressed by those who say, oh, you can't do anything in this world because you'll get a reaction. Well, you won't get anything without doing something.
Do you hope that if Senator McCarthy's campaign picks up, that this may cause some sort of reaction among voters
who
are now uncommitted?
I think so. Oh, yes. I think so. And certainly as far as student morale goes, McCarthy's the best invention since the wheel. If either McCarthy or Kennedy or Rockefeller should win next fall, we'll have a good chance of keeping thousands of our most morally sensitive, intelligent students in the mainstream of American life. Otherwise, it's really bad.
I'd like to ask you a question about Mr. Rockefeller. In his statement last week, I guess it was, when he decided not to run at the moment, the indication was that one of the reasons he wasn't running was that the main issue, which is Vietnam, his policy on that issue was not very far different from Mr. Nixon's. Therefore, what hope do those people who are in the peace movement see in a Rockefeller movement in the Republican Party?
Well, until the governor declares himself, it'll be hard to know exactly where he stands on Vietnam. Rumor hath it that he has changed his mind. He was terribly hawkish, but here's a man who is not the master of this policy and therefore has no psychological commitment to it. Here's a man who understands the crisis of our cities. Here's a man who has a kind of security which maybe Eastern Oil has over Western Oil, which will allow him to be a little less paranoid about this whole policy than the present administration seems to have become. However, personally, I would just as soon see the Duke of Rockefeller step aside and Sir John take his place.
Well, now, we've talked about it being an election year, and it's an amazing opportunity for the peace movement to express itself at the polls,
mm-hmm.
those of them who are old enough to vote. What do you think of the present administration? Do you think that President Johnson is a man doing his best in an extremely difficult job? What is your opinion of the man?
I think he may be doing his best, in which case I think we just need something a little better. I think the main problem is not that he's an evil man. I think he's just has a paralysis of imagination, you know, that we've gotten ourselves stuck in this fashion. We now have a kind of ideological, the administration is characterized by a kind of ideological paralysis. It sees things in black and white. It sees a monolithic, messianic communism against which we must, of course, do battle, which is just not accurate. It's just not subtle. It's just not a truthful way of looking at things. It keeps applying stale formulas that only half apply. And so I think the present administration has gotten itself into an awful lot of trouble, mainly by a kind of paralysis of imagination and ideological paralysis. I think it's very important that people in the protest movement recognize that it does not take an evil man to do an evil thing. Good men can do wicked things if they're just a little bit wrong, have a great deal of power, and have fellow citizens who remain remarkably complacent. So I'm much less inclined to fault Washington for the mess we're in than the complacency of the American people, who in the most unpatriotic way have remained blindly submissive to an asinine policy. But I think that's our fault. After all, in democracy, only some perhaps are guilty, but all are responsible. And the American electorate has not proved itself able to respond to a terrible situation, face up to it, look at it again, admit mistakes, and so forth. Instead, we keep responding to these terrible pleas, such as that pathetic plea of President Eisenhower, you know, close ranks. You know, close ranks behind a quack doctor who has proved he can't heal his patient. Close ranks behind a lawyer who's proved himself incapable of defending his client. Close ranks behind a teacher whose incompetence is monumental, you know. Close ranks is really saying close minds. And that's what we've been doing too long in this country. We've been closing our minds because we didn't have the courage to keep them open.
You, in this New York Times Magazine article on yourself, said, when asked whether you were a pacifist, you said, no, but it looks like it's 49-51 now.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel now?
49.5? Certainly I'm a nuclear pacifist. You know, anybody in his right mind knows that to get started on a nuclear path that could bring about a nuclear holocaust would be sheer lunacy, you know. I mean, better dead than red is probably the most stupid statement anybody ever said, you know, and those who say it will have plenty of chances to die, plenty of chances, only they don't have to bring everybody down with them. That's important, because when everybody's dead, there's nothing to be particularly moral about anymore, or intelligent or anything else. So I'm certainly a nuclear pacifist, and basically I feel that things are so tricky these days that no question about a brush fire being able to flare up into a major conflagration. On the other hand, what do you do if you're an Israeli, you know, and the Arabs are offering you the final solution once again? Do you really let the Egyptians and Syrians and others just come in and toss you into the sea? I can't quite, you see, bring myself to feel that all nations should do this unilaterally. I think arms control is what we have to work for. I think the internationalization of power is what we have to work for. I can't quite see myself being totally a pacifist. After all, nations do have to exercise not only restraint but occasionally constraint. But you can see I'm confused. I really think I'm almost personally a pacifist, even though I recognize that a nation can't become one for a long time.
It could be argued in the Israeli situation that if the Israelis were just to stand there and not defend themselves, that the Arab nations would not attack by the pressure of world opinion of a total slaughter on unarmed people. How would you feel about that?
Well, that's the kind of argument offered by pacifists which keeps me away from pacifism.
I think people have a way of personalizing ideals. You are the Vietnam resistance. And if you follow that line of thinking, and you look at Dr. Martin Luther King, he was perhaps at one point, he started out for for human rights, and then he criticized the Vietnam position. And he's now mobilizing the poor people to march on Washington. What do you think about this march on Washington of poor people?
Yeah, can I just correct a misimpression? I certainly did not mean to say all pacifists were naive in their thinking. I would not say some of my best friends are pacifists, and that would be misconstrued. But let me say I have the highest admiration for so many members of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and Father Hayes and Barragan and all these people, you know, they're saints. There's no question about that. It's just some pacifists are willing-minded, just as some of us non-pacifists are very willing-minded. Now, coming back to the King, I think the thing about that King symbolizes is the fact that the peaceful revolution of rising expectations, which he led, is now beginning to turn into the violent revolution of disappointed hopes. Now, he still is trying to lead this peaceful revolution in a nonviolent way. And Lord knows, if anybody deserves success in this country, it's Martin Luther King. I can't think of anything stupider than to try to deny success to Martin Luther King, knowing who's waiting in the wings to take over when he fails. If ever there was a moderate, his name is Martin Luther King. And the average American has just been, I'm afraid, just too stupid not to realize that, or too racist, perhaps. Now, what King does in Washington, I think, could be a very moving thing. Children with rickets sitting on the steps of hospitals saying, we can't go back to Mississippi until we're cured. Huts, these shanties on flat tops being delivered to the Smithsonian Institute for the historical record, or to Mr. Weaver's office, you know, as the man in charge of housing in this country. This could be very effective symbolic action. And, of course, there's some 3,000 people in a very nonviolent way just sit down in Washington. It can be very effective. However, Congress is not in a mood to respond to grievances. Rather than redressing grievances, Congress seems more intent on trying to repress those who are trying to raise them. And Congress will look at this as a sort of blackmail. Therefore, I would hope that the Urban Coalition, which was practically defunct a month ago, but which now has received new life, what with the concern of J. Irwin Miller and Henry Ford and other businessmen, and with John Gardner taking over the helm, I would hope that this Urban Coalition would come in with King, not side by side. It would have to be something a little bit separate, but not totally distinct from his effort. Also to demand that grievances, completely legitimate grievances, be redressed. And the combination of King and the Urban Coalition might produce some effect in Congress and might save the leadership of Martin Luther King.
Yeah, but now I think what might happen is that the movements, the various movements who have been following King and who have been following the Vietnam situation are going to be split, because there's going to be a march in New York on the 27th, I believe. The 22nd is Dr. King's march on Washington. Do you think there will be... maybe what I'm really asking is, what's the most important problem? Can you give values to whether we should stop the war, whether a person who's looking for something to do should go to Washington, or should he stay in New York?
Well, I think as regards Washington, King hasn't issued a call yet. Now, he may end up in the same situation he did in Selma, where he started with local folk, and he didn't want anybody else. Then he issued a call, and we all went down. It may be the same thing in Washington. He has not as yet issued a call. He wants a very carefully controlled group of about 3,000 representing very specific aspects of American poverty. So it may be that we shouldn't go down to Washington. Certainly we shouldn't go down without an invitation from him. To me, civil rights and the war have always been connected in a great many very obvious ways, the most obvious of which is the national budget. As long as we have $50 billion for defense and another $25 for space and another $30 for the war in Vietnam, we're not going to have any money to carry through on a war on poverty. The war on poverty has dwindled to a mere skirmish, to say the least. And so the connection between the war and civil rights seems to me is obvious. People used to tell us, you know, you shouldn't connect the two. It wasn't a question of our connecting them. They were connected. Only it took a long time for people to see it. Now I think they're beginning to see it.
A final question. I've asked you this every time I've met you, Mr. Coffin. What more can you do as an individual speaking out his feelings, trying to change a world with which you are dissatisfied? What more can you do? What do you plan for the future?
Well, I think we must continue to do what we're doing, and we have to get very straight in our own minds that ultimately what each of us has to do is that which is right. We have to witness to a truth as we see it, even if it means rotting in jail in order to do so. We mustn't be that concerned with effectiveness. On the other hand, penultimately, we have to try to be as effective as possible. Now I think the big thing is obviously the political effort, the 68. But I think in the long term, what people like myself and the religious community feel in terms of the season now, the Lenten season, is that we must stop being Christians in Galilee and start being Christians in Jerusalem.
It's been an honor having as our guest today, the Reverend William Sloan Coffin, Jr., chaplain at Yale University, an outspoken critic of government policy. We thank you for coming today.
Matt, it was a pleasure to be here. I've heard so many good things about this radio station, and I couldn't resist your invitation.
For Pete Feldman, this is Matt Bieberfeld.